Off the Ball Breakfast.
Well, you say doing double training sessions. I'd say he's being forced to do double training sessions, and he's there as a shell of a person.
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
Settle in on Off the Ball. Brought to you by Guinness 00, proud partner of Croke Park Stadium and proud partner of the GAA.
Yes, indeed. You're welcome to another edition of Settle In. I'm delighted to say that we've got a man in studio who's refereed two All-Ireland senior finals, and has refereed a Hogan Cup final, as well as winning a Hogan Cup final. David Goff, you're very welcome to studio. How are you keeping?
I'm well. Thanks very much for having me in today.
It's obviously a busy enough time to be a referee right now, especially in the game of Gaelic football. We might get to that at some stage in this interview, but this is a good space for you, isn't it? The Off the Ball studio brings back happy memories with your good friend Máire Thrasa Ní Cailleagan here.
One of the first interviews I ever attended in here was with Máire Thrasa on a D&I conversation, and we've become great pals ever since. I try and see her at least once every 3 or 4 months, catch up, and she keeps me on my toes in relation to the GA, and it's been a great friendship blossoming out of something so unique.
Absolutely. So when was that, around 2017, was it?
Just around 2016, 2017.
Okay. Do you feel that the conversation that you would have had that day is still the same conversation you're having today? Have things moved on? Where are we at in regards
to
that?
It's a completely different conversation today in relation to myself as much as where the GA has gone on their journey. I'm probably a different person to what I was in 2017. I'm not maybe as shy in talking about my sexuality. I'm probably a bit more open in telling my whole story when I wasn't as comfortable telling it in 2015. And then the GA has gone on its own journey since 2019. So it's a totally different space.
What changes for you over the course of those 7-8 years in terms of you being more comfortable in that area? Is it just repetition and telling the story for the first time in a public sphere and then kind of getting on with it, or how does it operate for you?
No, I think it's when you get, I don't want to say feedback, but when you see people's reactions to the interviews you do over time, you become less fearful of what they're going to say or how they're going to perceive you. And as my journey has gone on and people see me as David Goff, the referee, not David Goff, the gay referee, I'm more open and honest about my years in hiding, my struggles, my difficulties, when I started to come to terms with it. Because I was very shielded at the beginning. I might not have wanted to open up as much or been as willing to tell my full story back in 2015. But I'm in a totally different space now because of the general love and acceptance of my friends, family and the general public when I go around the GA grounds in the country.
When people are listening to this, we will be into the month of February, but just to pull the curtain back, it is the 30th of January when we were recording this interview. And I do want to make that point at the start of this, because tomorrow, the 31st of January, is an important day for you.
Yeah, but just getting emotional when you say the dates. Tomorrow will be 14 years since I came out very privately to my parents and family at home, the 31st of January 2011. And they're nice memories. They're not ones that I go back and revisit very often. But now thinking about it and seeing how far I've come, it's lovely to be able to sit here and reminisce over 14 great years.
Do you want to take us back to that day and how much you do look back on it when you think about it?
I suppose I'd have to speak about the weekend in its entirety rather than just the day. I left Dublin. I was teaching in St. Pius X at Boys National School in Terenure. And I had left very upset on a Friday evening, having come across a poem by John O'Donoghue called The Time for Necessary Decision. And I knew in that moment, after reading the poem, that, you know, life was going to change for me, that I had reached a point in my life that I needed to, as John says, take the step into the unknown and trust that a richer life awaits you there. And I went home to Slane that Friday evening. It was my cousin's birthday. It's his birthday actually today, and I went to his birthday and told another cousin of mine that I was going to tell my parents that weekend that I was gay. And it was the first time I ever used the words that, you know, I am gay. And she was very calm and relaxed about it. And I couldn't tell my parents all day Saturday. I went and I played tennis on Sunday morning with the local club in Dublin League. The Winter League had just started. I stayed on in the tennis courts in the afternoon because I didn't want to go home. And eventually I made my way home for dinner on the Sunday evening and called my parents into the kitchen and my brother. My sister was a little bit young at the time. And even saying the words "I am gay" were too difficult, and I kind of made up a lie that I had a partner and his name was. And I suppose there was a brief moment of silence. I think my mother thought I was after getting my ex-girlfriend pregnant. I had a girlfriend up to a number of weeks beforehand. And my father's a bit like myself. He's a very reflective man, and he didn't say too much. And my brother was just kind of shocked. We played football together in every team. We're Irish twins. We're 11 months apart. He's one of my umpires as well. And we've been together. Our GA journey has been together since we were very young. And I always played up in age grade on the teams he was playing on. And I kind of left with a bombshell, and what had taken me the best part of 13 years to come to terms with, I realised not long after that I couldn't expect them to come to terms with it as quick. But they were on the phone the next morning, making sure everything was all right. They had a load of questions. They knew I was upset, but they knew I hadn't been myself for a number of years before that either. And I suppose it was just the culmination of all those struggles coming out, and the instant relief, and I mean this, the genuine instant weight that comes off your shoulders when you get past that hurdle. And it is the hurdle of telling your family that I found most difficult.
Because they would see tomorrow as a significant day as well. I'm sure there'll be a phone call at some stage.
Absolutely. Mum and Dad will pick up the phone. There'll be mention of it. They always do. They say, oh God, it's so many years. And I'd say, yeah, God, didn't that go fast? And there'll be, isn't it great? You know, I'm with my partner, Tiago, now 3 years. And, you know, they just talk about how wonderful life has changed for me since then.
Have they been on a journey as well?
Oh, of course they have. And they've been on their own personal journey, I suppose. My parents are quite young. My parents are in mid-60s. And I suppose, yeah, coming to terms with having that conversation with their own generation. My grandmother, who's in her 90s still, she's my biggest fan, never misses any of my matches. She would have had to come to terms with it quite quick as well. But they went on their own journey too. But they went on it much quicker than I did. And I'm happy to say that.
That's really interesting. Much quicker than you did, obviously. It's more of an external view on it. Why do you think it was so quick for them? What is it about your family that I guess makes them such great people in that regard?
I don't know. I don't want to put them on a pedestal above anybody else's family. I just think they saw how happy I was and how difficult I had been for the 3 or 4 years previously, where I was grossly unhappy, coming home, causing arguments, fights, for no reason. I'm not that type of person. And they could see a change as, I suppose, my sexuality really started to weigh me down and my personality changed. And then to see it just lift, and to see my group of friends grow. I've mentioned tennis a lot. It's a tennis court less than 500 metres from the house at home. I grew up playing tennis all my life. I still play a very high level. I got involved with Out to Tennis in 2011, the LGBT tennis group, and I made friends, not just in Ireland, but all around the world, playing international tournaments, and just seeing how much fun I was having. And I suppose realising that life for a gay person does not have to be the life that they see on television with the clubs and nightclubs and bars and, you know, what some people might associate gay life to be.
What are those sorts of stereotypes that are in popular culture that you refer to there?
Well, I think they just, you know, the nightclub, the partying, the eternal being single, you know, just living a fancy lifestyle. Wealth, I suppose. I suppose people talk about the pink pound, that you don't have children to bring up or put through college or that expense, and that you have an extravagant lifestyle. And my lifestyle is not that extravagant. The glamour of GAA on a Sunday, you know, down in Ockram is not as glamorous as people would think. And sorry to the people of Wicklow, I'll probably get hit for that. But, you know, it's just a very nice lifestyle. And they probably saw that I just have a good life out of it.
When you talk about the 3 or 4 years of relative unhappiness before that moment, were there perceptions in your head of what might happen when you do come out that you were thinking about in those 3, 4 years?
Yeah. I had always been brought up to know that, you know, suicide was a permanent solution to a temporary problem. So I never had suicidal ideologies. So it was just about a fear of exclusion. And I know that, you know, we talk about inclusion, and that is it. I was really afraid people were going to treat me differently I have a wonderful family and a wonderful large family on both sides, and I just didn't want to be treated any differently. And same with the football team and the lads in the football club. I still wanted to play football. I didn't want them to have this, well, as I felt, issue around being in the dressing room with them, changing the showering scenario, going to the pub. Would they be able to talk to me about having a boyfriend now instead of having a girlfriend? And the general banter, if you want to call it that, that can happen. And I didn't want them to feel uncomfortable around what they could say and couldn't say. And just didn't want to be excluded. And they were all, I suppose, perceived fears, because none of them actually came to any fruition whatsoever. And I'm not saying that that's the case for everyone. I did lose one very good friend as a result of it, who was unwilling to accept that I was gay, and you know, that was something that I could be. But for the most part, nobody batted an eyelid, and most of them said, "Oh, we knew that anyway," which was news to me.
It's kind of a real contradiction of the GAA, isn't it? Where it is something that a lot of people lean on for inclusion, but by very dint of being involved in a GAA setup, it sounds like it was something that was almost excluding you implicitly, and something that maybe delayed you coming out eventually.
Yeah, that's 2011. I mean, we're 14 years down the line, and I know the GAA has come on a different journey to most other sporting organisations. I'd say at the time it was a small club. It's a different mindset. It was pre-marriage equality referendum. So all those fears would have been real in my head. But the GAA is somewhere where I truly believe we can all belong. We're not there yet. We've come a huge way, and they are making strides in what they're doing. Certainly at club level, I think the elite is something completely different. It is a behemoth of its own that hasn't been touched. But certainly within club levels, there's gay men playing for their clubs across this country, and there's no problem.
Can we go back a little bit before that then as well? You went to an all-boys school in St. Pat's in Navan. Obviously, unbelievably successful sporting career that you have with them, getting your hands on the Hogan Cup, obviously. To what degree did being in an all-boys school also hold you back in terms of expressing yourself, really?
Well, I'd say, first of all, the Hogan Cup, my brother won it as a cornerback in 2000. He marked Ronan Clark in a fantastic final in Cavan against St. Pat's Armagh. I was only a sub when we beat Jarlath Tuam in the final in 2001. But my memories of St. Pat's are mixed. And I can say that now because I've never really spoken too much about it before. While I was struggling with my sexuality, I had a great group of friends. Boys that I sat with beside the first day of school are still my best friends now. And they were fantastic friends then, and they were through my coming out and afterwards. Being part of the GAA team was something totally different. It was like we lived in a bubble outside what was going on in the academic side of the school. And I suppose to a certain extent, if people realised that I was gay or was potentially gay, I was the sporty gay. So I was playing with the football team. I was captain of the tennis team. My brother had gone before me, and there might have been a little bit more leeway given to me than if I was a transgender student or someone coming in identifying in a different sexuality. And you know, I fit in. I played the role of the straight football player, and I wore the jersey, and wearing it to a certain extent helped me cover up my sexuality and my sexual identity for a very long time.
It feels, as somebody who went to an all-boys school as well, it does feel that any sort of negative seed is just willing to go wild in an all-boys school. It's like, whether it's homophobia, whether it's, to be fair, to a degree, in racism in certain sections, certainly going back 10, 15 years ago, any sort of negative thing can explode in that environment. It is like a petri dish when you put a load of hormonal boys together.
It doesn't take much a little spark for the fire to ignite, and it can become all-consuming because, you know, you've that pack mentality among boys, and you don't want to be any different. You want to be part of it. And if you were seen as any different, well, then there's going to be almost a pylon on you because of your sexuality. And very few people at the time would have been upstanders, we'll call them, who would have stood up for you because of difficulties you would have been facing, it would have been far easier to join the pack and add to the misery of the person facing that than to stand up and say something. It wasn't part of culture in Ireland at the time. We're only 14, 15 years since I came out, but we're talking back 25 years since I was in secondary school. So the culture was completely different.
Definitely. I'm sure that's the case. At the same time, today, you wouldn't be awfully surprised if when you have a group of boys together in school, there is still that poisonous culture that naturally festers. I sometimes think that if you're excluding half the population from a school, you're exposed to 50% less experiences in school. And as a result of that, that leads to quite a embedded in, ingrained way of backward thinking.
I don't know whether I'd say it's backward thinking, but having taught in an all-boys school and having seen children from that school go to another all-boys school, I would say that I don't think it's healthy for males to go through their whole educational career between first level and second level, and at the age of 18, never had to sit down and converse and work or group work or chat informally or engage with females. It's just not natural. And I find as an educator, as a principal of a mixed school now, I think that it would be far greater benefit to our society if schools were mixed from primary school right the way up.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there for sure. And the other thing, and like, forgive me, this is like a very blunt instrument comparison, but like, again, exposing yourself to 100% of the potential population that can come to your school, like you even look at it in sport right now. The idea of coming out in women's sport is like a laughable concept. It's like, what century is it if that was brought up? Whereas it still feels like a thing in a male-dominated sport, in men's sport, so to speak. And you just have to say that as a gay person in school, in an all-boys school, that's surely replicated into the education system. Again, probably too blunt an approach of a comparison, but I wonder if there's some truth there.
I'd say there is some truth. I mean, you couldn't not but think that. I think it would be wrong not to think that. I mean, you've mentioned ladies' sport, and we have so many role models in Ireland who are out and happily lesbian and competing in their clubs, but also at elite level. And that transfers all around the world. Unfortunately, we don't have the same in male sports. Most people would struggle to name five male athletes that are out and gay in world sport, in elite sports and worlds. And the same then has to be transferred back to the education system. You know, if it's so common or not so common, I think that's, if it's so much easier for women to do it, why is the problem there for males?
As a teacher, did you notice in the all-boys school, for lack of a better phrase, almost uneducated or even innocent homophobia going on in terms of the discussion between students?
I wouldn't say it was innocent homophobia. What I'd use is the pejorative use of the word gay. And you have to remember, I was in a primary school. So it wasn't as hard-hitting or as vitriolic as it can be in secondary school. You know, the children might have said, oh, homework's gay or he's gay, but not really have understood what it was. But there was no more vitriolic terms used. Like, we're talking children up to the age of 12 years of age. I don't think it was overly prevalent, if at all prevalent. I can think of one incident in my 14 years in the school where we had to deal with it. But I mean, that's minuscule in the greater scheme of things.
And the other thing that you said there a moment ago, like, I'm always interested in, like, you know, when somebody does come out. I mean, we're speaking this week in the week of the David Coote story, which you might get into in a moment. But there's often a tone whenever a man in sport comes out, as I've mentioned before, with regards to women's sport, where people are like, oh, why is this a story? Somebody coming out in this day and age. But actually, that's a societal thing being projected onto sport. Like, if you look around and you talk about the numbers of people that people could actually name that have come out in Irish sport, for example, the list is very, very short. It actually is not a reflection whatsoever of men in society at all.
I think sometimes people think when men come out in sport that they're weaker than, that they're lesser, that they're somehow perceived to be not as good at their job as they could be if they were straight, whereas the opposite is almost true for females in sport, where they're seen stronger, as more able, more capable for some reason, or even just equal to the others who play sport. And there's this perception for some reason, whether it is down to social media or the views people would have had of gay people that they would have seen in, on television in the 70s, 80s, 90s. They wouldn't have been the sports stars that you might see today. You know, and if you think of, I don't know if they're if they were camp or effeminate or they were the attributes that were afforded to gay people, the thought that someone could be performing elite sport like a Garrett Thomas, you know, playing rugby at such a high level and such a brutal sport, you know, the concept that that would just that that someone at that level would be playing who has also happened to be gay, just didn't it just I don't know if it doesn't appeal, but it just didn't seem to fit the norm for people. It didn't fit the box they wanted to put people in. So I'm not really sure. I that was a fear when I came out that people would see me as weaker than or more effeminate for some reason. And I suppose because of that, I strive to be at the very top to show that, well, I'm able to do this. I'm as capable as any other referee in the national panel to perform at the highest level in the most pressurised situations in Croke Park. And my sexuality doesn't affect that.
When it comes to what the GAA have done, what they're doing, where are we at in terms of that organisation? Is it fully supportive? Is it moving in the right direction? Or is there still a little bit of lip service paid to all sorts of conversations, but specifically to do with LGBTQ+.
Yeah, I'd like to be balanced on this because I know there's a documentary coming out in June that I have done in relation to the lack of out male LGBT athletes in Irish sport. And the GAA has come on a journey from 2019, having a diversity inclusion officer. She left the role last year. The role lay vacant for quite a number of months. It is now filled again. We have the Na Gael Éireachta here in Dublin, an exclusively, well, not exclusive, but it is an LGBT club, and they're playing football, hurling, camogie and ladies football. We've Éireachta Ulla up in Belfast, who are doing the same thing. We now have Super Value, which I've been involved in for the last, I think it's 4 years this year, could be year five of the diversity and inclusion campaign. They've had rainbow laces campaigns. I wore rainbow laces in the All-Ireland semi-final in 2020. I think it was Tipperary and Mayo, having not been allowed to wear a rainbow wristband 5 years previously. So they've come a long way. Have they done enough? No. I'll be blunt about it. There's still a long way to go. They certainly have reached grassroots level, but as I said already, the inter-county game is a behemoth of its own, and they certainly haven't made inroads into creating the type of atmosphere that would allow a gay man come out in elite sports just yet.
Right, so there is a disparity there between grassroots and inter-county.
Well, as a result of this, I can say this, having gone through the documentary, there's a huge disparity between the club and the inter-county.
What sort of things are you experiencing that's leading you to come to that conclusion?
Well, it's no different, I'll be clear on this, for the GAA than any other sporting organisation in the country at the moment. We have grassroots flying pride flags, wearing rainbow laces, but at elite level that doesn't happen. We have it in ladies sport, but you talk to a men's team, and by the way, we could get no GAA inter-county player from the 32 counties, hurling or football, to speak to us about this matter. Everyone was interested, but when it came down to sorting a time for an interview, there was just silence, and I mean no response. The contact was cut, and we couldn't even get Uachtaráin Cumann Lú Chleascaoil to come and speak to us about this matter. So it's a really difficult one for me because I feel like I'm flying the flag solo. I've beaten down the door back in 2015. And we have done so much, but the inter-county game is just not touched. And it speaks back to the GAA banning Mayo wearing rainbow numbers on their jerseys a number of years ago to highlight a charity cause. It speaks to the fact that no pride flag has ever been flown inside the GAA stadium, and clandestine rules had been written around that at the time to ensure that that wouldn't happen. They'll fly it at the museum outside, but never inside the stadium. We've no pride rounds. We don't have encouragement of county teams to wear pride laces. And this ties in then with the GPA, who, although they have a fantastic officer, they're not really reaching the inter-county teams as insofar as male inter-county teams. They're doing so much, and the ladies' teams are so receptive, but the men, not so much. They never speak about their potential gay counterparts or colleagues. There would be no pride round. There would be no laces worn. And I am here as an advocate for the LGBT community, saying visibility matters. Your silence in this area is what's preventing people like me from coming out, because we don't feel that it's a safe enough environment. If you want us to come out and want us to bring our full authentic selves to the inter-county scene, create the space and show us that you're going to be inclusive. And when we feel comfortable, then we'll come out.
Why do you think there was nobody willing to go forward and do those interviews for that documentary?
I'd say they're scared insofar as the LGBT world and the language, and sometimes the social media attacks can be quite heavy if you say the wrong thing. It is an education piece. I'm still learning. The alphabet soup of LGBT-isms is massive. I wouldn't like to educate anyone on it, because I'm not as well educated myself. And I'd imagine there's a genuine fear that they might say the wrong thing, that they might be perceived themselves to be allying to LGBT causes, and then for some reason, like Conor Myler recently, you know, suffer homophobic abuse just because you're petitioning for a certain cause.
That's kind of mad, isn't it? And I guess that's also not just a reflection on them, it's a reflection on society in general, that this is the sort of immediate thoughts that would prevent them from doing something fairly straightforward, you'd think.
It is kind of mad, but if I was to relate it back to my own experiences, I had perceived fears about coming out. And I would say equally, it is fair to think that they might have perceived fears in relation to speaking about this, and maybe not being able to speak about it. Maybe they don't have the education. And I don't mean leave insert education. I mean education around LGBT issues and what they can do as allies and upstanders for us in their own dressing room cultures.
The disparity point is really interesting between grassroots level and elite level. Part of that has to be down to visibility, right?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. There are so many gay males playing sport around this country, and particularly in GAA, and it doesn't bother people at club level. And I suppose maybe the scrutiny isn't as high, the media profile isn't as high, and probably people in their own localities always knew anyway, or it was common knowledge. It's much more different at inter-county level. But I look back at my own experiences and I see the way 80 inter-county referees reacted to me coming out. They never treated me any differently. They were absolutely fantastic in the way they responded to this little bit of information they now knew about me. But like that, when we had the Rainbow Laces campaign, I'd say about 3 or 4 of them wore them for championship matches, and not many more, even though they were all given a set and told, you know, this is important to me. There is a visibility aspect to them. And most of them wore them. Some of them, to be honest, most of them were teachers, wore them. But some of them just did not want the attention or were afraid they were going to be asked to make a statement on why they were wearing them.
So that comes back to the language point again, that they were afraid of having to comment publicly on it and not know how to manoeuvre that conversation.
Partly. And then, you know, despite everyone's assertion that, you know, the referee loves to be the centre of attention, we don't. If we're the centre of attention, there's a problem. Yeah. There's no reason for us to be spoken about unless there's a problem. And wearing the laces is giving an in for them to be the centre of attention, you know, and it didn't take off. And that is probably why inter-county footballers didn't wear them as well. They were provided by the GPA to every inter-county unit, a box of laces. If you multiply that out, that's thousands of laces. And I think 4 players wore them on the Pride weekend.
Wow. When it comes then to the reception that you get, I'm sure there have been, or at least were, fears about potential abuse in the stands or online. Have those fears ever come to fruition in reality at all, or are you actually pretty good in terms of what you receive?
Online, there's a block button, okay. and I've filtered my Twitter. I don't have Instagram or Facebook, so it's fairly well filtered. I can only recall once having homophobic abuse. Twice. Once following the Kerry Dublin semi-final in 2016, and a Tailteann Cup game between Down and Cavan about 3 or 4 years ago in Breffni Park. And while I didn't act on it in 2016, I'm in a totally different scenario now. It was reported at halftime to the event controller that what had been said and who said it. And before the ball was thrown up at halftime, the guards had the man removed from the grounds.
Really?
Yeah.
Right, so that would give you great encouragement then.
Absolutely.
To report it next time.
Now, and we shouldn't have any fear of reporting it. It's unsavoury, it's certainly unwarranted, and there was no need. I was actually having a good game that day, so I didn't understand why it was being thrown at me.
Yeah, you would think that if somebody heard that level of abuse in the stands and terraces as well, it shouldn't necessarily be up to you to point them out as well. Surely there'd be enough people in the stands to point that out now. Like, would you have faith in the general public at GAA matches to actually act in that regard?
I think I would. I think people would be horrified in that now an awful lot more people would be more conscious of knowing relations, people in the locality, friends, family that would be part of the LGBT community and wouldn't want that type of language being heard. And there are children around. And I know we always say there are children around, but there are children at Gaelic games. Like, it's fantastic to see them. And you wouldn't like to think that they're sitting there listening to that type of language either.
For sure. Now, I do want to touch on a couple of the bits from the David Coote situation this week. So he's done a couple of interviews this week. And when you watch the interview that he's done with The Sun, they make this cut. And at the very start, it says, "So I'm gay," is the first thing that says. And like, it's actually in the middle of the conversation. So they're clearly front loading this. It feels, to be honest with you, like a bit of a classic outing. It's a bit of an uncomfortable watch. I know he's since done an interview with Sky Sports as well. There's one of the lines in this interview. "I became good at hiding my emotions, which is a great quality as a ref, but a terrible quality as a human being." And there is this kind of theme about trying to suppress his homosexuality that pervades throughout the interview. Again, it doesn't really feel like David Coote is overly comfortable doing this interview, to be honest with you. But that point about being good at hiding emotions, great quality as a ref, terrible quality as a human being, does that resonate in any way?
Well, yes, it does. But firstly, I'd say if I was about to come out, The Sun wouldn't be number one on my list of newspapers to make that statement.
Especially since they were the ones who did him in the first place.
So, you know, you wouldn't have to read too much into that to know maybe what's going on behind. But certainly I can, I feel from when he says, you know, suppressing the emotions. And I would say, and I often have said, that I wore a mask for years. And I was very good at hiding my emotions. Well, I thought I was, you know, and playing up to the role of the GA player or the sporty gay. Well, I wasn't openly gay at the time, but I felt I was doing a good job. And I can completely empathise with the situation he's found himself in. But I do realise what he's saying in the comparison in refereeing terms. We are the ones on the pitch that are so emotionally uninvolved to what's going on. And it's a great skill to have, to be able to be emotionally uninvolved with decision-making, around decision-making. I often see it when I'm making decisions as a principal. My partner mightn't think it's the best thing ever, but, you know, I'm able to stand back and not allow emotion take over and make decisions just based on purely what I see and linking it to rules. So I understand what he's saying.
And granted, this is a very different sporting scenario here, where it's just the Premier League. It's just, I cannot begin to imagine what it must be like to be a Premier League or a Premier League referee. But then also on top of that, you've got a different country and a different society there as well. Which is interesting, like reading Barney Ronay in The Guardian this week on it. He wrote a brilliant piece on the back of it. And just one of the lines that he has is that the fact is homophobia is a big problem in football, not least at grassroots level, where last year's Football Association review reported a near 20% increase in allegations of discrimination relating to sexual orientation. So this is obviously the UK. That's an astonishing increase. Now, that may be because people are more happy to report allegations of discrimination and they recognise that it's wrong, but really it's a stark figure. Even speaking anecdotally, David, is there anything like that happening here in this country, or are we very different to that figure?
I don't know, because I mean you'd need to know your background and figures better for me to comment on something like that. I do know, having listened to Belong To speak about their school climate survey, that incidents of homophobia are still prevalent in secondary schools, and the type of incidents that children are, and they are children even though they're in secondary school, have reported. And it's shocking to hear, in their words, what can happen in dressing rooms, what's said and what is done. So it is happening. I can't say because I don't have the figures whether it's on the rise or not. Are we similar to over across the water? I don't know. But it is there and it does exist.
The other thing that Ronnie points out is a couple of other things. He kind of touches on a theme that you brought up earlier on, the sort of implicit connection in some of these stories between homosexuality and a hedonistic lifestyle, almost like the cocaine habit and the homosexuality going hand in hand. Granted, not what the Sun were trying to do, but I'm sure there's almost a deep-seated thing there when people see that headline. The other thing he asks is David Coote being gay a story on its own merits? Which I think maybe is a fair question, but actually on the other side of this conversation, it's probably worth asking you, is a referee in England being gay a story in its own merits?
No. I mean, you're talking about a number of high-profile referees in the UK, not just in soccer, have already come out. It's not a big deal. It's not a big story. And I feel sorry for him to a certain extent that this has gone through. I know what it's like to have your sexuality on the front page of a newspaper. It's not easy. But I was never forced into the situation. And, you know, I kind of feel maybe that is the situation David has found himself in.
Yeah, it does feel deeply uncomfortable. Phenomenal chatting to you, David. Thanks so much for coming into us and very best of luck with the new rules over these next few weeks.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Settle in on Off the Ball, brought to you by Guinness 0.0, proud partner of Croke Park Stadium and proud partner of the GAA.